Well, we have about 45 minutes for questions, and I would ask you, if you have a question, to please identify yourself and your affiliation and which of the panel members you would like to answer the question. Please.
I'm Carol Yost, and I direct the women's programs at the Asia Foundation. And Mr. Dean, I wonder if you could comment about the women's organization's role in fostering moderate views of Islam, moderate practices of Islam. What are the most effective strategies that you know of in the region, and how can those be supported?
Very good question, a key question. I appreciate it. You see, up to, let's say, 1970s, most of the activism that was sanctioned by the governments in the region, I'm talking about mostly the Middle East that I'm more familiar with than Southeast Asia or Indonesia, for example. I'm not that much familiar, although I'm getting more interested. And also I'm talking about Central Asia and the Caucasus, which, you know, the Caucasus and Central Asia had totally different experience, very state-centered, state feminism, if you will, under the Soviet version of modernization and emancipation. But mostly it was by elite women, the organizations, and usually one single organization connected to the state. And if you wanted to do something, you had to become member of that organization. And if you didn't believe in the state, which was the case for a majority of women, you wouldn't join them. Or you would look at their activities with suspicion. Oh, these are just some elite, upper-class court women, you know, westernized. They are not really caring about women on the street and ordinary women. So that's why there was a gap, wide gap, between the state-connected, state-supported or state-dependent women organization and wider society of women. Unfortunately, grassroots women's organizations were not allowed, no NGOs, independent NGOs. But the pattern has been changing. There is kind of a paradox here. On the one hand, the surge of Islamism has set back the rights and spaces for many upper class, modern middle class women. But on the other hand, has opened new spaces for traditional marginalized women who were newly urbanized, who were newly educated, who had to cover their hair in order to be able to mingle with men in society. I remember when I was at Tehran University, I started seeing these women coming with a headscarf, and the number was growing. Yeah. And these were the women who were coming mostly from traditional layers of societies, who were being educated as the first generation in their families, or who were representing the newly urbanized women, whose traditional parents would not allow them to go to university unless they covered themselves. So that, when Islamism became prominent, it kind of provided a way for many women to negotiate modernity. This kind of veiling that we see is not, has not the same function that the veil used to have, necessarily, to seclude women and keep them in the private domain. It is a way to make public space possible for them to move in public space. So that kind of activism, and because they are being also politicized, it is also part of the whole identity politics which is going on. We are now witnessing an unprecedented number of highly educated women who are trying to kind of reclaim Islam and redefine it, reinterpret it on their own terms and from women's perspective. Actually, one of my dear colleagues, Margot Badran, is here, who has worked extensively on this phenomenon of Islamic feminism. Mm-hmm. And the grassroots women's groups who are working in the frame of Islam, mm-hmm. trying not to alienate themselves from the community, but they are saying the same things that secular feminists are calling for. Not always the same things, but there are commonalities between them and secular, westernized, or modern women. So what has been working, especially in recent decades, there has been an interesting convergence between these layers of women who are working from within the faith, trying to kind of subvert and at the same time reconstruct religion in a more women-friendly and egalitarian way, between those women and secular, modern, feminist activists who in the past kind of dismissed this group and looked down on them as if, you know, if they are wearing scarves, so it means that they are ignorant or they don't count as women activists. So the convergence between these two groups and coalition building among them has become very effective. But the problem is that now there is a tension at the same time that there is collaboration, that still there are secularists who see this Muslim feminist as a rival or a threat or a source for perpetuation of Islamism. And on the other hand, there are sectarian and very ideological Islamists who still think that Islam is the only path for women's liberation, and they don't want to collaborate and have anything to do with secular modern women. So this tension and debate and negotiation is going on within women as well as between women and the whole process of modernization. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to acknowledge these differences, to go for pluralism and work with respect to that part of your question, what kind of intervention, policy intervention can work, is that especially with regard to intervention of outsiders, like donor agencies, they should really take into account the voice, the diversity of voices, and not limit themselves to the westernized, English-speaking, modern-looking, Western-looking women. In order to reach the grassroots, they have to also work with those women and bring them into the game and incorporate them in the political game, in NGO movement, and even in electoral politics. The more they get incorporated in the system, the less radical they become, and the more realistic they become, and less utopian and ideological they become. So that is the experience of, especially because, fortunately, there's both economic need for women to work, so men cannot, you know, stop them from working outside, and also there is literacy rate that has been growing. Women are becoming better educated in many Muslim countries than men, actually. In Iran, under an Islamic government, women showed their agency. Now we have just the recent data in terms of with regard to the enrollment of women in universities show that 52% in some fields, 60% in some other fields are women students who are enrolling in universities. So,
please.
Hi, I'm Judah Kirtler. I'm with the Assembly of Jewish American Association. Dr. Zahidi, I'd like to
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions, a little bit tied together. One is, you talk of the double standard that male society is embracing modernism, but also, on the other hand, sticks to a male-dominated value system. But there's also, especially in countries that are a little bit more modern, like Turkey, in terms of in relation to others, as you say, that those circles also embrace democracy, but in a very strange way, that they, for example, do not advocate that kind of democracy, free thought, and this enlarge their own space in society, in the club space, they become all of a sudden very democratic. Would you like to comment on that? Maybe I'm wrong with that observation. And secondly, you mentioned that Islam is really not the reason for Muslims, women in Muslim societies to be becoming, to be left behind. But in fact, some of these issues that, some of these rules that make women left behind are inscribed in what we know the Sharia, and it is known that unless it is changed, and cannot change the word of the Quran, unless that kind of reform takes place, I don't see how Islamists or Islamic societies will make that kind of change. And thirdly, I haven't seen any women's organizations, really, even not in Turkey, where there are moderate Muslim women, you know, working for change in terms of women's rights in Muslim societies, but usually they work very effectively in actually propagating or, you know, getting support for a certain Islamic party or building up their grassroots support. What kind of women's groups are you talking about in terms of modernizing the role of women from an Islamic perspective? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All very good questions. Let me start from your second question. Yes, when I'm saying that Islam is not the root cause, I'm not overlooking the contribution and role of Islam in perpetuating women's subordinate status and lack of equal rights. But I'm saying that religion in everywhere, not just in Muslim world, is only one factor. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be addressed, but it's not the root cause, because there's a tendency, unfortunately, in the West and also among westernized secular women who think that everything has to do with Islam. And that is paralyzing. Why? Because if you think everything is Islam, there are two conclusions made. Those who are believers are going to say the only way for salvation and for emancipation of women is Islam. And of course, they are going to give you their own interpretation of Islam. And for those who think that the main culprit and cause of women's subordination is Islam, then it means that millions of women who are believers have to, let's say, faith, because they are not going to live away, you know, put aside their religion. It's very hard to do that. So it's not practical, and it's not accurate theoretically either. So that's why I'm saying that religion only has its role in interplay with other factors, and that is the reality. Religion of Islam of Indonesia is different from Islam of Turkey and Islam of Iran and Islam of Saudi Arabia because of different contexts, different politics, different everything. So, and there are strong liberal, modernist, and egalitarian Muslims who have been for years trying to reinterpret or actually read the text of the Quran in a more modern and, liberal and egalitarian way. And these reformers have been overpowered, the voices and role of these reformers have been overpowered by the reactionary, radical, extremist, traditionalist one because of lack of democracy and all those things that I mentioned. When you have, like in Kurdistan, you see, it kind of confirms what I was arguing, that democracy is key. When people are ruling themselves, then, you know, there isn't as much, men don't feel as insecure. Mm-hmm. They are empowered, so they don't feel that they have to stick to the only place they have, which is women and children, to exert their masculinity and power. They have citizenship power. And so these voices of moderate and reformist Muslims, in many countries you have now intellectuals who are among men and women, like Islamist feminists in Islamic feminists in Malaysia, Sisters in Islam. They are doing excellent job. They have small pamphlets publishing on every issue, educating women. Like, is polygamy a Quranic injunction? And they're explaining why it is not. They're just deconstructing the whole patriarchal interpretation of the Quran. Mm-hmm. You can't say that the words of Allah cannot be changed. The text is silent unless you read it. And when you read the text, you read it with certain presuppositions. You don't read the same text, Victor Hugo, for example, today, the same way you read it 100 years ago, right? Because now you are coming up with different values, mm-hmm. different presuppositions. So if your presupposition is that women are, second-class women should be slaves, whatever, then you're going to read the Quran and select the verses that works to your benefit. So is violence accepted in Quran? Can men beat their wives? That's another pamphlet they have published. And they show, they deconstruct again all these interpretations and show that that's not the case. So fortunately, there are ways to... You see, interpretation is not just a theological game. It is political. It is power game. Mm-hmm. And if women are equipped with the knowledge, which is very important, especially those who are believers. You see, I'm a secular, irreligious person. Mm-hmm. I respect everybody's religion. But that's not my job, or that's not the job of, say, foreign minister of Britain, or to say what Islam is. The new definition, the democratic definition and construction of Islam should come from within the faith. And fortunately, it is happening. What we can do as an intervention is to support those voices, those forces, and to make distinction and discrimination between the radicals, extremists, anti-women, and the ones who are for change and for progress, and not to put everybody in the one, category. So that is one thing about Islam, especially in those countries that still Sharia is the basis of the family law, for example. You cannot just overnight say that I'm going to get rid of Sharia. It's a gradual process to reform Sharia, bring a feminist, modernist, democratic interpretation of it. The other questions of you, I guess, I don't want to take most time.
Yeah, I was going
time.
To wonder if not.
I hope I can get back to that because I want others to speak.
You started a very good line here. I wondered if you wanted to comment a bit on that.
Well, actually, exactly what I tried to present in my paper is also is this, that certainty, especially where Muslim are majority, there are a lot of political problems, and that has allowed men to really overtake everything, and the politics of the situation, security has become the priority, and the women rights within the family was, put at the second stage. So when there is democracy, when there is, freedom of expression and a need for, everybody in the society to take part, we will have the solution. To just complement the last point that the professor mentioned about the Sharia being the law, for example, in Iraqi Kurdistan, during those 10 years, we have changed some of our laws, especially the ones that deal with family and women issues. And lately, we are discussing lifting the, we have in our law, in Iraqi law, this excuse for men when they kill for honor, to get reduced punishment. Now in the Kurdish society, in the parliament, including many civil society agencies and women groups, we are discussing to lift that, because that process is gradual. It cannot happen immediately. Right. But it is happening when there is a development of a civil society and the freedom of expression. It will happen gradually, and I would support that it will happen gradually rather than be imposed, because that's then it's more powerful and strong.
I wanted to add a little bit on the Sharia and later on talk about the Islamic educational system. The Sharia supposedly has points there that really protects the rights of women, but in situations like the Philippines, where the ones who codified Sharia law, and this is now what we use in the Muslim South when you talk about family and personal laws. The men codified it very biased towards their point of view. So since the codification, which happened in the early 70s, laws have been passed by the Philippine government, which tries to push forward women's rights. And the interesting thing is the landmark legislation that really pushed for women's rights was authored by a Muslim woman senator who happens to be my mother. And now, oh, that's an interesting point, because the senators of the Philippines, or 24 of them, are nationally elected. And there have been Muslim senators in the past, males. My mother is the first woman to be elected senator. And interestingly enough, the first Muslim to be re-elected. And to cite that even more interesting fact, there were many Muslim men who ran for the Senate. And during her first election, my mother came out as second in the Muslim provinces. During her re-election, she came out first in Muslim provinces. So this sort of negates this opinion of many that Muslim women, because of religion, have a secondary role. So let me go back to the problem that we have now. We have progressive legislation on women. The question is, how do you now make it merge? How do you synchronize it with the Sharia, which has been codified, and which, according to the agreement between our government and the rebel forces in 1996, it is the Sharia that will be implemented in arm. And just to cite some of the bad provisions of that law, a woman cannot be legally recognized as a partner of her husband in providing for the family. So when you're talking about business, the woman has no rights. But Philippine law says, yes, women have equal rights. So how do you work out the problems? In case of disagreement over parental authority over the children, the father's decision prevails. Of course, in our communities, nobody really attends to this particular point of the Sharia. It is the mother who makes the decisions with regards to the family. In the case of divorce, the wife does not have equal rights as the men. Now that is one issue that the men are really contesting in the Muslim area. So as of today, you have to look at your customary laws and the national laws and try to make sure that the customary laws are brought up to the same level so that it protects all rights, men and women. Now, a little bit on Islamic education. When you're looking at policy intervention, how best to secure the rights of men and women, one cannot escape the role of the educational system. After September 11, women like Jessica Stern have been describing the madrasa, the Islamic schools, as recruitment camps for terrorists. And although that has been true in many areas, even in Muslim Mindanao, where the clerics have a very radical point of view. Their point of view about Islam is narrow and at times quite violent. But still, the Islamic educational system is key if you're looking at reforming Islamic society. Therefore, there should be, from the international community, a concerted effort to look at how can you work with the madaris and forget sometimes this law that says there is no separation of church and state. First, because in many Islamic societies, you cannot separate the two. That's one. And the second point that would allow for greater intervention in madaris, in the Islamic educational system, is the point that what you're trying to do, for want of a better word, is to secularize religious Islamic education in the sense that you make it grow out from a focus on the Quran and Arabic to include now discourse on math, sciences, the rights of men and women, ethics, transparency. So you are making the Islamic educational system more responsive to the needs of men and women in today's society. So if you can work out appropriate programs to strengthen reform the Islamic educational system, then you have gone a long way in securing the rights of men and women, as well as a long way in building a foundation for peace in areas which are now very conflict prone.
Yes. Sorry, could you speak up?
In the center and south.
Yeah, and also given the fact that there's such a big population in Iran and elsewhere in the Arab world in this diaspora.
Yeah. Well, Women Union has been always, you know, there has been a great and extensive networks of Women Union across Iraq, and even now they play strong and they play a role, but that role has been manipulated to serve the politics of the central regime instead of serving the women right. And that's where the conflict is. I mean, and that's the conflict of the center and south. In a way, you know, they are very open, they promote women, but they don't promote them for their own self and interest, but they promote them for to use those networks to reach everybody and to promote their doctrine of controlling and security watching. And of course in the center and south we all know there is absolutely no opposition. Movement are allowed to work freely, so I don't expect any outside that circle of Women Union who are controlled by the central system of controlling, I can't see any, unfortunately. It doesn't exist now, and that's an unfortunate thing. And one thing that has been happening in this rest of the country in the last 10 years, which is unfortunate, I mean, you see more women covering, but not because of the rise of Islamic movement. It's because of social protection, it's because of economic, some of them, maybe they don't have, from what I heard from even as close as my sister-in-law who moved, who was living in Baghdad but moved now to the and living with us now, she was telling me stories about how people, because they cannot, economic situation, they cannot dress up, yeah. And they prefer to go into the Islamic dress because it's cheaper or it gives them, and then it also doesn't attract attention to them, which could lead into also negative happening. In terms of diaspora, you mean Iraqis living outside? There is a very active Iraqi woman activity on the on every aspect of art, literature, painting, but mostly outside, who are living in Europe or America. Refugees who are living in Iran are living in some of them has developed, who stayed there for more than 30 years, they have developed a life, and they have adapted to the general, culture of women in those countries, like in Iran. And we do have, for example, some of the Kurdish returnee who came back in the 90s, who spent 20 years in being refugees in Iran. They came and they brought back the Iranian culture of dressing, of taste, decoration, landscaping. But for us, we don't find it so, oppressive. Actually, it's like diversifying the culture. But for example, they still wear in an Iranian way. They have been affected. So Iraqi who left the country, wherever they are, they have been affected with the culture of wherever they are.
There's a question over here. Please.
John Kalawi from the UN. Dr. Tahiti, did I hear you say that you don't believe that laws can have any impact on the situation? You were saying the change should come from below, it should come from the culture and the society. That actually is not how Turkey has worked, and it's actually not how most progress
has been
made on civil rights for women and minorities around the world. So could you explain that to me?
I'm glad you...
Oh, right,
of course. No, no, no. I, How could I say that? as a sociologist. No, that's why I emphasize in my talk that change should happen from both top down and bottom up in order to complement each other. For example, if you don't have a law against genital cutting or genital mutilation, it's not enough just to leave it to gradual. I mean, there are certain things that law is really key. I mean, it's a key. But I'm saying that only by changing the law overnight, you can't expect massive changes. It has been like the case in the Soviet experience, that although the law was very helpful, but it took years and years to really change some of the traditions. And I mean, people even were doing things against the law because they were accustomed to do those things. There were even members of Communist Party who would, in addition to the registering their marriage through civil law, they would in secret go and see a mullah, someone who pretended to know, because most of the educated mullahs were gone anyway, but to just feel better that, okay, I also had nikah, that is the sharia-based marriage, so she's not really, she's not haram. You know, even communist members of the party, because culture and ideas and beliefs change slowly, and it takes generations sometimes. But you can't wait for that change to happen when it comes to the law, because there are certain people who can use the law. I myself benefited personally to escape an arranged marriage because there was a law in Iran, even though many women were not even aware of that law. But that reform in the family code could save me. So I'm the last one not appreciate change of law or reform in the law. But I'm saying that it's very important to understand that legal reform is not enough, and the best way to reform the law is to bring in, you know, massive participation of people so that they know, they value, they appreciate the change. If they are not even aware of it, you can another government can come and suspend that law. That's what happened in Iran. We had the family protection law, but because it was done just by the elite without participation of many women were not even aware of it, did not appreciate it. And when Khomeini came, changed the law, only thousands of women protested, but it took only 1 week, and then we had almost silence for years until, again, going back to one question here, who said many of these Muslim activists are just propagating Islam and propagating Islamists. But the paradox is that after several years, since they have become socially active, they feel empowered, they have discovered their agency, then they are going to get into conflict with these Islamist men who are leading them. That is what happened in Iran. Why do you think in Iran majority of women voted for a change, voted for a reformist president? Women had the key role to play. Many of these women are disillusioned with the Islamist clergy because they have seen the utopia they promised, that there's going to be an Islamic society that is going to emancipate women. What they did in practice was they restricted the family law to the interests of men, and they gave unilateral right to divorce to men and the right to polygamy. So even a Muslim woman who's supportive of the Islamic project doesn't want to have another, to be second wife, to have polygamous relationship. She is disgusted with this project. She's outraged with the unilateral right of men for divorce. So she starts opposing it. She starts reading the Quran for herself. She starts to questioning. Who said if the God that you are defining to me is so cruel to women, I don't want that kind of God. You see, that is the process that should happen, should take place, and complement the legal changes.
Beautiful. Yeah.
An additional point on the issue of law. I was with the Philippine Commission on Women for almost 10 years, and we supported actively the SIDAW and other UN instrumentalities. But this is the problem that we saw in the Commission on Women. Law is good for the elite women because they make it a point to know what their rights are and how they can support their rights. But in a situation like rural Philippines, in a situation, for instance, like the ethnic conflict in Mindanao, where you have 800,000 homeless and who have not been resettled since the year 2000, several things happen. Number one, there is no one that informs them about all of these new laws that protect their rights. Even new government programs that they can approach so that they can get assistance to develop themselves or to put up a business, there is a lack of knowledge. And there by itself is a point of intervention. How do you make women aware at the grassroots level that there are agencies of government or multilaterals they can run to, that there are laws that protect them and support them? That's one problem. The second is, in many areas and many groups of women that I have dealt with, even if they know the law exists, they just cannot find the time or the need to get those laws to support them because their priorities are completely different. Their priorities is to make sure that the daughters and the sons survive. So it becomes imperative in areas like Mindanao that the first thing that you deal with is to settle the ethnic conflict. And how do you do that? You make sure that the demands, for instance, of the affected groups are sincerely attended to and that a program is provided that does assure an end to the conflict. You have to look at the poverty alleviation programs. I mean, I have heard these debates many times in Manila where the elite among the women, both Muslim and Christian, we talk about the importance, for instance, of a piece of legislation that allow women to get their own passports or their own bank deposits based on their signature without getting their husband's signature. For them, this is very important because they go to Paris, they go to Hong Kong. Then I go down to Muslim Mindanao and I talk with the rest of my sisters who are there at the village level. And they don't really care. What they want is for a government program that would provide them 500 pesos, the equivalent of $10, so they can put up a small stand in the market, sell vegetables. Unless you can clearly understand, for instance, what are the most immediate needs of the different groups of women, because there is no such thing as a Muslim woman, and the gender divide, for instance, that is very important to women like me. May not be that crucial to the majority of Muslim women who just want to make sure that the family survives.
That's not different from women anywhere.
Exactly. So it is not religion.
If she wanted to send, because I've been in family situations where the mother decided that children were going to school, because she had the right to have her own bank account, the children went to school.
But they don't have the money for the bank account. That's the basic problem.
They're not exclusive. What I'm saying is we have to do both things. We have to
yes.
work on the laws, and we have to work with the women. It's not different from Muslim women than it is from Christian women.
Right.
Or
that's right.
Jew women or Buddhist women.
That's right.
The question of poverty and the sense of the society and their rights. And I think one of the questions I've been asked before is what kind of civil society, what kind of organizations can we work with in trying to promote these kinds of things? Because usually women learn from other women.
Right.
Do you want to?
Just to support the argument, it's very interesting for me to see how similar the issues are and how we see them as women who are reflecting on the situations in each society. In Iraqi Kurdistan, civil laws are very protective of women. But just to support the argument, it's the women who are not taking advantage of them most of the time. I mean, some need to still change, but basically the civil law is protective. I mean, if a husband beat her, she can go and put him in jail, for example. Or if he marry a second wife without getting her permission, there is a sentence that he could go. But women are not taking advantage of this for several reasons. So one of the reasons they don't know about it, so they need to be educated on their rights. when they are available. When they are not, they should be educated to demand more rights. And secondly, provide options. Because most Muslim societies are very family-centered and close, many women would feel they wouldn't like to bring, you know, shame to the family by leaving the household of the husband, or it's not something good to do. So many of them, or they have no other place. If she go, and I'm talking about abuse cases or cases that of second wife or any other cases against women, if she doesn't have the alternative house that can take care of her if she stand up to her rights, then that's also an issue. And that's what we try to create. We try to create shelter homes for women, for example. And it is run by an NGO, not by government, not by anybody. It's an NGO that's opened a shelter house for women who are endangered, who some of them, you know, are endangered for so many different reasons, and some of them for economic reason also. So, I mean, there are several things to read.
One last question, so please. You got your hand up first, so.
I'm Nalini Natraj, and I'm from Women's Studies at UW, but I teach at the University of Puerto Rico. It seems to me that there can be a conflict for women between the family support group and the law. I mean, because law can empower women, but the implementation of law often practical factors such as, you know, where do I turn and what is going to make my support group come up. And I think the issue, for example, with inheritance, where you can have laws that guarantee women inheritance, but the process of actually executing that can have women have, you know, fight with their brothers and the support system that they usually rely on, especially for poorer women. So I think the pace at which community support can keep up with women's community support can keep up with the other support, you know, the family or tribal support, that can allow women to take these options the law gives them. You know, it's really, the two have to sort of be in step, and often they're not, so that legal developments actually get not used because of the process that you just go through.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much for these presentations. I think they certainly have helped me begin thinking a bit about the issues that come out of this. And I, as I mentioned to you, Gail, earlier, I think this is a subject that really deserves some deeper attention from different perspectives, because of the, as we've seen today, quite remarkable similarities, but still a sense of different perspectives, and putting the role of religion in a broader context, I think, is very, very important. The economic and the social, as well as the religious, all affect the role that women play in societies in Muslim countries. So I think we all owe our panel a round of applause. Yeah, I don't know if you want to say anything.
I want to thank so much USIP and Pamela all for really putting all this together, and Amina for doing so much work on it, and Richard for moderating and being so open. And I hope we can do some work like this. This was an extremely good and an active discussion.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.